Thank you, Rabbi Turevsky, for the very kind words of introduction. Thank you even more importantly for the invitation. It has been a while. We've had the opportunity to do this together. And it's a big, big highlight, personally, of my Elul preparations of getting ready for Rosh Hashanah, for the Aseres Yemei Teshuva, for Yom Kippur. First and foremost, I guess, because in the season of a lot of Ashamnu Bagad news, and we list all of our sins, and we talk about all the things we do wrong, it's nice to hear some kind words and a good introduction. Makes me feel a little bit better about myself and think that maybe we have a chance to get through this season okay. Much more importantly, being here for me and being associated with a yeshiva, I teach in Reshit during the rest of the time, being involved with NCSY and being able to participate in shiurim and in learning in a seminary like this one, and I don't know if there are very many that are exactly like this one and have this special quality, it's a very, very important and great way to prepare for Yom Nuram, to prepare for Rosh Hashanah. Because what exists in this seminary, what exists in this room every year, I'm not speaking about a first judgment that I made just from walking in here a minute ago. I'm talking about the impressions I have from the years that I've been having the privilege of doing this and of speaking with you and of learning you with a little bit. There's a very, very unique type of energy, a very unique type of attitude that pervades this seminary, that pervades this Beis Medrash, and is a big, big chizik to me personally. And it's the energy of possibility. It's the knowledge and confidence that there's such a thing called change. And it's the knowledge that we can together accomplish amazing things over the course of this year. That we want to grow, that we want things to be different, that we don't know exactly what form that growth is going to take, or how things are going to change, how they're going to evolve, what the finished product is going to look like, but that we are in a laboratory of introspection, a laboratory of growth, a laboratory of change. And I don't know of anywhere better to spend the days leading up to Rosh Hashanah and leading up to Yom Kippur than in such a laboratory, than in such a Beis Medrash. So I thank you for the invitation. It's an amazing chizuk just to spend a few minutes in this Beis Medrash and in this seminary with people who are so committed and so excited about the mystery and about the possibilities that the year has ahead of it. So this time of year, people tend to speak about the same things. You're going to get up here and we're going to speak about tshuva. We're going to speak about growth. We're going to speak about the davening. We're going to speak about the shofar. So I assume that my main topic, or at least my introductory topic, the first point I want to make to you, is something that you've heard a lot about, which is the architecture of sports stadiums. The unique way that different sports stadiums are constructed and built, and why there are two basic models that exist. In the 1970s and 80s, around the United States of America, they tried to efficiently make very much cookie-cutter, identical round stadiums that a football team and a baseball team with a minor adjustment to the field could play in simultaneously. You had football games that were taking place across a baseball diamond, and you had stadiums, if you didn't know better, and if you weren't familiar with the uniforms of the teams on the field, you would have no idea what city or stadium you were in just by looking around you, because they all looked exactly the same. They were round. You have the same thing in arenas for basketball and hockey today. They all have the same lights floating around them, the same dimensions of the court in front of them, the same advertisements on the billboards, almost the same capacity more or less. Nothing that distinguishes them one for the other. Of course, there are a few exceptions. Fenway Park in Brooklyn, in Boston, excuse me. Wrigley Field in Chicago. Places that have very, very much idiosyncratic elements to their stadiums, the Green Monster or the ivy on the walls, maybe different dimensions, maybe a different look. In the world of the gyms of yeshiva sports in New York City and the surrounding metropolitan area, there is a similar phenomenon. There are many beautiful gyms in the high schools that some of you attended, whatever high school it may have been, in New York, outside of New York. There are many gyms that are virtually indistinguishable one from another. And almost all of them are in that category. Some are older, some are newer, some have this logo or this color, some might have a different one. but they're essentially designed to accommodate different genders and different sports. You could play floor hockey and basketball, volleyball and soccer. You'll accommodate a gym period and as many spectators as you may get to whatever league games you may have going on, and that's what you have. I attended a high school called MTA, Yeshiva University High School. And MTA plays its basketball games in the Yeshiva University gym, which is slightly larger, but basically identical to all the others. But it plays its hockey games, and it runs its gym periods on a daily basis in a different gym, which is the MTA gym, in the basement of a very old building, and it's a very old gym. And it is a very unique gym. I said basement, like this base measure, it's a good place to indicate what I'm talking about. The gym has two features that make it completely unique. Number one is that it is low, and number two is that the space of the gym is limited to the playing court itself. There is not a single bleacher, not a single chair that could fit in the gym when a game is going on. We'll get to that in a minute. It has a very, very low ceiling, which means that if you played a regulation competitive league game, you wouldn't be able to play there at all. Because the ceiling is so low, it alters the shot. To this day, you can tell if you go to Ganapamon and you watch, I don't know why anybody here would ever do that, but if you go to Ganapamon to watch a bunch of guys from the Yeshiva League playing basketball, you could always tell an MTA guy by the low trajectory of his jump shot. Because we all learned how to play in a gym where the ceiling was only a bit higher than this one right here, and you had to learn to shoot almost on a line drive. But back to the other dimensions, the fact that there are no seats or there are no stands. They play competitive hockey games. The MTA Lions hockey team plays in this gym, and there is no place to watch except for the fact that around the gym there are 7 or 8 high windowsills that make for a total of about 21, maybe 25 seats for a hockey game. If you ever go, maybe your brother played or someone else you know, if you ever attended an MTA playoff hockey game, you'd have people crammed into the doorways, maybe 20 people around the doorway, standing on a chair trying to peer over. The players would see almost no fans and almost no spectators because there's no place for them to be. Those 20 to 25 seats on the windowsills are the most prime piece of MTA Sports real estate you could imagine. Not anybody gets to sit in those seats. Not anybody gets to sit on those windowsills. And as a Rebbe in MTA, which after going there as a student, I had the privilege of teaching there about 20 years ago, as a Rebbe in MTA, I had one student who was very adept at hockey. He became the captain of hockey. Captain of the hockey team means you have certain privileges. And he had, not just for his parents, but he had an extra seat or two that was allocated to him. And he said right away, Rebbe, do you want to come to our hockey game? I have a windowsill seat, one of mine, you could sit there. So for every MTA home game that year that I was able to go to, I sat in that windowsill right next to his father, and we had a great bonding time watching his son, my student, play hockey. Why am I telling you this? You're probably wondering that, and you'd be right to do so. I appreciate your listening to it in the first place, because you can't possibly have figured it out. Late in the season, there was one game where that seat, which again, if someone's not there, someone replaced them right away, that seat was empty. In between the second and third period, huffing and puffing and out of breath, wearing his business suit attire, his father comes rushing into the gym, makes his way onto the windowsill, catches his breath, and he turns to me and he says, Rabbi, you know I don't miss these games for just anything. You know it has to be important that I miss the game. I have the most incredible story to tell you. Now, this is the only time in my life that this has happened to me. As a rabbi, as a public speaker, you think we collect this all the time. I've been waiting for the repeat. It hasn't happened. But he said to me those words that you hear in Hasidic stories. He says, I'm going to tell you the story after the game, but only on condition that you tell the story to as many people as possible. You need to tell the story because I want the world to hear it. I want the world to understand. So I'm going to fulfill his commandment. He did tell me the story. It is a great story. I'm going to fulfill that commandment. I'm going to tell you the story that he told me on the windowsill of the MTA gym of his day's event that day almost 20 years ago. And I'm going to try, before I tell you the story, to tell you why that story is so important and so central to what we have to try to do over the next few days in preparation for Rosh Hashanah. We are in the time period, of course, that's called Elul. And Elul has a few distinct characteristics, its own idiosyncrasies. Elul is the time, of course, first and foremost, of tshuva and preparation for Rosh Hashanah. And Elul is the time of blowing of shofar, of serving Hashem in that particular manner. Elul is also, as everybody here is very familiar, an acronym for Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li. And right away, at the very, very beginning of our discussion, we encounter a reality. We encounter the fact that the efforts that we make during the time of Elul, as much as they are about individual work, as much as they are about connecting to Hashem on an individual basis, as much as they are personal, and as much as they are intimate, listen carefully to what I'm about to say, there is also an element of the avoda, of the work of Elul, that revolves around relationships, that revolves around what is expressed in Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li. Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li clearly is talking about man's relationship with God. And therefore, you could challenge what I just said and say, well, that's not true at all. It's only about one relationship. It's about the relationship that man has with God. But Elul is not so much about the relationship we have with each other. I would dispute that on no fewer than three different levels. First of all, Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, even though it is speaking about man to God, is the language of deep personal connection and relationship, the likes of which we associate with Bein Adam L'Chaveiro before Bein Adam L'Makom. Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li has been appropriately appropriated to be a sign of affection between husband and wife, between people who care about each other, who love each other deeply. And it's not coincidence that we use words that are so applicable to man's relationship to his fellow man in describing our relationship with God. Second, the acronym Elul, Aleph Lamed Vav Lamed, has multiple explanations and multiple words that are attached to it. One of the other ones, famously as well, I doubt I'm telling you anything that you don't already know, are Ish L'Re'ehu U'Matanos L'Evyonim. That's a strange acronym for Elul, but that one that reflects the fact that contained in this same Elul that is about our individual and intimate relationship with God, we are describing something that is also connected more to the world of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, and also Ish L'Re'ehu U'Matanos L'Evyonim. Rabbi Stuart Weiss, he's a rabbi in Renana, made Aliyah from Los Angeles a number of years ago. He writes regularly in the Jerusalem Post. A couple of weeks ago, in the Jerusalem Post, he posed one of the age-old question of the Yomim Noraim, which is why do we have at such a prime moment during Yom Kippur, Mincha Yom Kippur, why do we have such a bizarre Kriyas HaTorah? For those not familiar, the Kriyas HaTorah of Yom Kippur is the Kriyas HaTorah of the illicit relation between man and woman, the prohibited relation between man and woman. The prohibition against sleeping with one's a married woman or incestual relationships or any of the other inappropriate relationships that are prohibited by the Torah. And the question that has been asked for so long is, why is that the Kriyas HaTorah of Yom Kippur? Because man has a particular need to do tshuva in those areas, and this is meant to inspire him. Because man is easily distracted, and at the critical moment of Yom Kippur, he needs to be refocused on what is good and what is bad, what is appropriate and what is not. These are all suggestions that are given. And Rabbi Weiss suggested, along the lines of what we are saying, in connection with Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, he suggested very simply, because talking about relationships, healthy relationships, contrasting them to unhealthy relationships, inappropriate relationships, illicit relationships. Talking about relationships is a major part of what we speak about throughout all of Elul, throughout all of Rosh Hashanah, throughout the Aseres Yimei Tshuva, and up to Yom Kippur. This is not a non sequitur. This is not speaking about something that has nothing to do with what we've been doing. If at 10:30 in the morning on Yom Kippur, you were doing tshuva, and you were trying to connect to the Ribono Shel Olam, you were doing it through relationships. So at 4:30 in the afternoon, when they take out the Torah, and they read a list of do's and don'ts regarding relationships, that's not out of place or strange. That's entirely consistent with the theme of the day and with the theme of the entire time period of Elul, Rosh Hashanah, Aseres Yimei Tshuva, and Yom Kippur. To be in Elul is to be in a relationship. And to be in a relationship is not at all limited to be in a relationship only with God. It's to be in a relationship with God while relating, connecting to other people. Perhaps, as we're going to see in a minute, even through our relationships with other people, we achieve a relationship with God. I want to share with you a remarkable, remarkable comment by a modern-day posek. He passed away only a few years ago, called the Tzitz Eliezer. It was a great posek in Yerushalayim, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. The Tzitz Eliezer was asked a question, which if you would have asked me this question only a month or two ago before I saw his words, I would have dismissed it out of hand. I would have said I wouldn't call it a silly question, that would be a little bit rude, but I would call it a question that's not really worthy of our attention or the attention of any great posek. The Tzitz Eliezer was asked about a, unfortunately, relatively common scenario. In fact, it happened to me last Friday. Last week, I was in America. I flew back on Thursday night, Friday morning, and I had to daven Shacharis on a plane. There's a whole discussion about davening on a plane and davening in a minyan and disrupting the flight and dealing with the stewardesses. Most people, although not all, I've seen it both ways, most people during the month at Elul, even if they think you should have a minyan on the plane, and even if you think you should have chazaras hashad, and even if you think you should gather as a big group in the back, most people draw the line at tekiah shofar. You do not find many people blowing shofar on an Elul or United flight, even into Tel Aviv, and in fact that was the case. There was a very fine minyan on the plane for shacharis, but there was no tekiah shofar. The Shulchan Aruch brings down the minhag, the Mishnah Berurah quotes the minhag of blowing shofar during the month of Elul. And here you had a shacharis, it happened to me not 5 days ago, here you have a shacharis with no tkiyah shofar. So there are two possibilities of what a person can do, with of course the third possibility that you do nothing at all. Possibility number one, let's say you have a full minyan, an entire yeshiva, is flying to Israel on Thursday. They're going to land in Ben-Gurion at noon on Friday. They're going to rush to the yeshiva before Shabbos. So one possibility, which is debated in the poskim, Rav Moshe has a tshuva about it in the Igros Moshe, other poskim discuss it. One possibility is at mincha time, even though we don't normally blow the shofar at mincha, even during Elul, but at mincha time, you get together, what difference does it make which aleinu you blow it after? After davening at mincha, you blow the shofar. Okay. The Tzitz Eliezer deals with the other option and the other possibility. I get home from my trip to America, say hello to my wife, say hello to my kids, maybe sit down for a minute, have a glass of water, go down to the basement, take out my shofar, and blow shofar for myself. I don't know how to blow shofar. I call up my Baal Tokeya friend and I say, can you come over to my house and blow shofar for me? This is, of course, there's an entire chesed industry. I had a student in Reshit a couple of years ago who made as his first goal when he got to yeshiva, he wanted to learn how to blow shofar. Okay, why did he want to learn how to blow shofar? Because he wasn't sure he was going to be able to withstand the entire long davening. He thought it might be a bit much, a bit overwhelming. He wanted to make Rosh Hashanah a day of meaningful religious activity. So he wanted to be a volunteer to go around the community community to all the veteran people, all the sick people, all the people who couldn't make it to shul, all the moms with young children, all the bedridden. He wanted to blow shofar for them all day. That's what he wanted to do. That's a beautiful gesture. And we know there's an entire world of people who blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah in solitude with someone coming to blow for them, or they blow for themselves in the comfort of their home if they can't make it to shul. So I would think, naturally, I would think two things, quite honestly. The first is I would think is, I get off that plane, and when I get home, it's a day in Elul, I should blow shofar. I should blow shofar like everybody else. I didn't get a chance to do it in shul. I wasn't in shul at Chakras. I don't want to go with the mincha plan. So in my living room, I'll blow shofar. Can make a nice game of it with my kids. They're always up for a little bit of shofar blowing. Everybody would be excited. It's a win-win for everybody, except for my next door neighbor who's trying to take a nap. Everybody else is going to be happy, and everybody else wins. That's not actually what I would have answered you if you would have asked me this question. I would have answered you, who cares? It's a minhag. It's not a mitzvah. Do whatever you want. If you want to blow shofar, blow shofar. If you don't want to blow shofar, don't blow shofar. It's not a mitzvah midoraisa. It's not even a mitzvah midrabanan. Do whatever you want, and it doesn't really matter. Who cares what you decide to do at noon in your house when it comes to blowing shofar on a day that you missed Shacharis with a minyan? That's why I'm not the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer doesn't say, yeah, of course, blow shofar. And he certainly doesn't say, who cares? The Tzitz Eliezer emphatically decides that there is no purpose. You want to do it, you're not going to get in trouble. It's not the Avera that we read about a few weeks ago in the Parsha of Baal Tosef. You want to blow shofar, I'm sure the Tzitz Eliezer would rip the shofar out of your hands. But the Tzitz Eliezer says, this particular minhag, this particular practice of blowing shofar and Elul does not apply to your living room. You want to follow those opinions that say you blow it at mincha, knock yourself out. But if you want to try to blow it in your living room, you're not accomplishing much of anything. He begins by making a textual argument. He says that the shofar of Elul is connected to two things that we know about. It's connected to the shofar that was blown when Moshe Rabbeinu went up, not the first time, but the second time, when he went up for the 40 days to beg for forgiveness for the Jewish people after Chet HaEgel. And the pasuk says, "Shehaviru shofar b'machane, Moshe Allah lahar." They blew a shofar and Moshe went up. But when I translated that pasuk, I skipped the word machane, and the Tzitz Eliezer points out, why does the Torah stress that they blew the shofar in the camp? Because blowing shofar in the camp matters. The other thing about shofar that we know about is the shofar inspires us to tshuva. There's a pasuk in Navi, the pasuk says, "Im yitaka shofar ba'ir, v'ha'am lo yecharadu." Can there be a shofar sound blasting in the city and the people will not do tshuva? Once again, the Tzitz Eliezer says, just read the words. That shofar of tshuva, that shofar of inspiration, is specifically stated in the pasuk to be sounded ba'ir. Could have said very easily, and we need to think about this for a minute, it could have said very easily, "Im yitaka shofar ba'bayit." Could there be a shofar in my living room? Could there be a shofar in my bedroom that does not make me scared, that does not rattle me, that does not inspire me to tshuva? But it doesn't say that. It says, "Im yitaka shofar ba'ir." Could there be a shofar in the city, in the community, and in the congregation? And listen carefully. After, you may find those proofs to be compelling. You may find them to be less so. I suggest you look them up on your own and discuss them with your teachers and with your friends, and you could figure out whether you think his textual proofs work or not. That's not the astounding part. Listen very carefully to the Tzitz Eliezer's following words. V'yitachen lahasbir zos gam b'svara. I can explain this to you as well with simple logic. Don't open up a chumash, don't open up a navi. Just ask yourself the question, should I blow this shofar in my living room or not? Writes the Tzitz Eliezer, "Shehais orurus mikol shofar." Whatever inspiration I may get from the sound of the shofar, "Mikablim rak kishishomim kol hashofar b'tzibur. I get that inspiration only when I hear it in this room. Only when I hear it in a group. Only when I hear it in a congregation. His orus kazos lo ba'a. This inspiration does not come kishitokin biyachin beino levein atzmo. Whatever thousand reasons of symbolism and meaning you will be able to give to the shofar. What I just read to you is not at all obvious. It's not at all clear why that should be. It is, in every sense of the word, astounding. The Tzitz Eliezer writes, whatever inspiration you may draw from the shofar, whatever you think the shofar provides and symbolizes, whatever the shofar means to you, does not work as well when you are on your own and by yourself than it does when you are in the tzibur. Why then on Rosh Hashanah do you have a Reshit student running around to a little old lady and blowing a shofar when it's just the two of them? Because it's a mitzvah midoraisa that you are able to fulfill even biyachid. Presumably, the Tzitz Eliezer would say though that the effect of the shofar is lessened when it is blown by oneself, as opposed to when you blow the shofar in a tzibur or in a congregation. The words again of the Tzitz Eliezer, his orus mikol shofar, the inspiration of the sound of the shofar, mikablim rak kishishomim kol hashofar b'tzibur. It is only possible when that shofar is blown b'tzibur. How is that possible? How does that make sense? The Tzitz Eliezer says he wants to explain to us a svara, a logical argument, but he does not spell out for us what exactly that logical argument is. Why is it that the magic of the shofar, that the impact of the shofar, is felt only b'tzibur and not b'yachid? Why is it that the shofar works and the shofar influences us only when we are together as a group and not when we are by ourselves? In fact, as we began with in describing the nature of the anagrams of Elul, this is not as surprising as it sounds, because there is a very critical interaction between the world of Bein Adam L'Makom and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro that carries us through all of our religious life and all of our religious experience. We know that each of our avos had incredible characteristics. We know that our avos were known for certain traits and were known for certain things. Now, if I asked you, what was Avram Avinu like? It's a harder question to answer than it may sound like. We know a lot of stories about Avram Avinu, but what made Avram Avinu so special? What made Avram Avinu great? So if you think of the answer right now, and I can guarantee you that the room is split, probably not 50-50, but probably closer to 75-25, 70-30, because of the way we're taught in elementary school. That's a discussion for a different day. But most of the room is thinking about Avraham as being the paradigm of chesed. Some people in the room are thinking of Avraham as being the one, the first Jew, the one who discovered God, and the one who defied all conventions in the world in identifying himself as a believer in God, as the founder of monotheism, and the father of all the world's great primary great religions. That's a very, very bizarre combination of traits. How can it be that Avraham simultaneously was this ultimate example, this paradigm of chesed and kindness, and at the same time, he was the world's greatest philosopher? He was the individual who was credited with discovering God and with founding monotheism that so many of the world's religious practitioners are basing themselves on. How is that possible? It would be analogous to my telling you that Bibi Netanyahu is not only the Prime Minister of Israel, but he's also the greatest violinist in the state of Israel. It's almost the case, actually. We'll talk about him in a few minutes. But the current head of the Jewish agency, Natan Sharansky, happens to be, because of his Russian roots and heritage, he happens to be one of the greatest chess players in Israel. Okay? It could happen that a person with incredible renown in one area has also equal renown in another area. But it's very, very rare. It's very, very unusual. And especially if you're talking about two life pursuits, they're usually mutually exclusive. What are the odds that the best violinist in Israel would be Bibi Netanyahu? Unless you took the violin to your path to fame, and everybody knows you as a violinist, then you enter politics and you get elected, like Ronald Reagan the actor, or somebody like that. Generally speaking, it's really, really hard to be known for and to be a world leader in two things simultaneously. Clearly, there is a common denominator between Avraham's chesed and Avraham's philosophy, between Avraham's bein adam l'chaveiro and Avraham's bein adam l'mako. The simple answer, which most of you would suggest to me if I gave you the opportunity to do so, is that of course there is a relationship between the two. What is the starting point and what is the so-called end point? The starting point is Avraham's philosophy. You believe in God and therefore you exhibit acts of kindness. I cannot stress enough to you how true that is and how important that relationship is. One grows in his or her relationship with Torah, relationship with God, and if it's done properly, they have with that characteristics of chesed, characteristics of kindness. It doesn't just make us better servants of God, it makes us better people. When you want to know whether you are growing in a healthy way or an unhealthy way, when you want to know whether your experiences here in Israel are healthy and appropriate, or God forbid less so, that's the right formula and the right litmus test to give yourself. Am I a better friend for the hours I spend learning? Am I a better daughter for the hours that I spend davening? Does my sitter and does my chumash make me a better person, a better doer of chesed? Does it make me better in the relationships that I have with others? A simple connection that says, sure, the best Jew is going to be the biggest Baal Chesed. The one who discovers God is going to be the one who discovers kindness, which is the antidote to the evil selfishness in Sodom and in other places of Abraham's world. That is a smart model, that is a true model, and it's worthy of its own discussion for the entire time about how that model works exactly and how to avoid it, because we know it doesn't work for everyone. And we know there are corruptions of our beautiful Torah. And we know there are people who learn and people who daven who don't exhibit this type of kindness, this type of sensitivity, this type of selflessness. And yes, that means they're doing something wrong. Yes, that means there's a corruption. And like I said, that could be a discussion for a different time. I would like to suggest to you, following the words of the Tzitz Eliezer, that that is not the only direction traffic is flowing down the street, from belief to kindness. Rather, the reverse direction is happening in a significant way as well, from kindness to belief. The two explanations I will suggest to you for Avraham Avinu's biography and the two explanations that I will suggest to you for the words of the Tzitz Eliezer, that there can be a person who develops a sensitivity to others, who works on Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, who knows what it means to be in a chevra, who knows what it means to be part of a community, and in doing so, finds themselves open to the discovery of God in ways that were before impossible. The first explanation, and the simpler of the two, is simply the fact that we are all vulnerable, and we are all imperfect, and we all need each other. The missions that we have in life, the things we want to accomplish, This is why we get married. This is why we have friends. This is why the ideal seminary for each and every one of us is not the seminary which has individual attention. That's good. And not the, we have the most individual attention in the world. You're so rich, you could have a seminary that is made just for you. Sometimes in yeshiva, when we have discipline issues, we'll tell the guy, we'll say, listen, if you were the only guy in yeshiva, we might be able to do X, Y, and Z, which would be a better environment for you. So you have the wealthiest Jew in the world, and he wants his son to have the individual, he wants his son to have the greatest educational experience. So he looks in the books about education, and he says, well, class size is a big deal. 40's not good. 30's not good. 20's not good. Well, I bet 2 is not good. I'm going to send my kid to Israel, and I'm going to start a yeshiva. Yeshiva Benny. It's going to be Benny's yeshiva. He's going to be the only student. He's going to have a world-class staff. He's not going to have to share 4 people to a dorm room. He's not going to have to wait online in the Chanar Ochel. He's going to have whatever tiulim he wants on a big air-conditioned bus that he could sit in by himself. Well, it's not going to work. It's not going to work for the 2 reasons we're describing right now. Number one, we are vulnerable. Number one, we can't do our life's work on our own. That's when we went off on the Benny tangent. That's why we get married. It's why we have friends. It's why, on a very pragmatic level, we need each other. We lean on each other. We rely on each other to provide for us and to work towards our goals in ways that we can. We even inspire each other. We help each other. And that's the way that we're successful. That's the way that we're able to do things, anything in life. This is the message, of course, of the Machatzis HaShekel, not to confuse our seasons and holidays, but the notion that a Jew is identified by the Machatzis HaShekel. We are all half. We are all incomplete. You want to discover God? Don't go on that expedition. Don't go on that hunt by yourself. Don't try to do it completely alone. Take a friend. Go with a chavrusa. Go with someone who cares about you. Speak it out with them. Work with them together, and you will find the mission more easily achieved. You will find the hunt much more manageable. But of course, it is more than that. There's a deeper explanation for why Avraham is Avraham in both of these components and why we seek out others in our pursuit of a meaningful, healthy, strong relationship with God. Perhaps the single biggest challenge of our generation is the challenge of rampant self-centeredness. It is the challenge of believing that we and we alone are not just the center. That's like our parents' challenge. Not just that we are the center of the world, but we are the only thing in the world. There is nothing else in the world that matters but us. I'm going to tell you something remarkable that I believe from the bottom of my heart. The biggest obstacle towards belief in God in our world, in our community, is not any philosophical question, is not any great doubt. The biggest reason why so many of us can't see God in this world is because so many of us can't see anything but ourselves in the world. If I in this room right now am cognizant of you and your feelings, if I know that someone but me exists in this world, then I have the slightest fighting chance of acknowledging that somewhere in this room God exists. That somewhere in this world there is a God. But if I spend all of my life with the realization, with the conviction and belief that there is nothing in the world but me, if I've never confronted face to face the fact that there's something else in the world but me, then there is no chance that I will ever acknowledge, that I will ever believe that God is there too. You cannot skip a step. What's the highway? What's the direction of the street that we were describing before? Avraham acknowledges the existence of others. Avraham is a Baal Chesed. And through his being a Baal Chesed, Avraham discovers God. It was not the godliness that created the Baal Chesed. It was the Baal Chesed that created the philosopher. It was the ability to connect to others, to relate to others, to look beyond myself, to realize my own inadequacies and deficiencies, the greatness of others, to be inspired by others, that opens me up to the possibility of belief in God and of relationship with God. There is an incredible, I mentioned before, his proficiency as a chess player. There is an incredible story that is told about two heroes of the entire Soviet Jewry movement, the entire refusenik phenomenon, two of the most famous individuals in that struggle that defined a generation in Russia and abroad. Anatoly Natan Sharansky and the great Rabbi Yosef Mendelovich, who I hope you all get a chance to meet or hear from this year, even if you did already in high school. He lives in Givat Shaul, right near Har Nof, and he's an amazing, amazing Jew and an amazing person. And Rabbi Yosef Mendelovich writes the story of his being in, well, actually starts the story before he was in the Gulag. He describes the story of the day that his mother died. He did not grow up with a Jewish education. He did not know what the rabbis were saying or what the rabbis were doing. But he describes eloquently and beautifully, standing on a cold Russian day at his mother's grave, listening to some rabbis chanting Kaddish in a foreign language. He was curious enough to ask them, in his moment of pain, his moment of mourning, what are you saying and what are you doing? And they said, we're saying Kaddish. And he said, what's Kaddish? And they explained, Kaddish is a way of connecting, acknowledging, telling God, describing God's greatness, and being, making sure that we're not alone in our moment of vulnerability. And as a young boy, Yosef Mendelovich was changed for life. And he said to himself, Kaddish sounds like a pretty cool thing. And I may not know Hebrew, and I may not know God, but I'm going to learn Kaddish because my mother is no longer, and I would prefer not to be alone. And that's what he did. Yosef Mendelovich learns Hebrew so that he can learn the Kaddish. And he learns Kaddish, and Kaddish becomes his best friend, and by extension, it is God. Fast forward many years, Yosef Mendelovich defies the Russian authorities. He gets thrown into the Gulag, and he is a cellmate, one cell apart, with Natan Sharansky. And they communicate famously, a well-known aspect of their story, they communicate famously by whispering into the pipes that connect the toilets to each other. It's their own game of Russian telephone. They can barely make out, but they can communicate with each other a few words a day that breaks their solitary confinement. Yosef Mendelovich is in his cell one day. He hears through the toilet telephone, he hears Natan Sharansky crying. He asks him, why are you crying? And Natan Sharansky just says, my father has died. My father is dead. Yosef Mendelovich feels terrible for his friend. He feels terrible for the fate of a person who can't even bury or sit shiva for a parent and the loneliness that Natan Sharansky must feel. But then he remembers the Kaddish. He writes down on a scrap of paper, he writes down the Kaddish, and he goes out every day to the exercise yard. The exercise yard is a triangle of extended solitary confinement. But the cheap Russians have holes in some of the ceiling panels that connect between these solitary confinement triangles. And there's a tiny crack that Yosef Mendelovich can throw his balled up piece of paper. He can throw it through. Every day he goes out to the yard and he whispers, Natan, Anatoly, are you there? And when Anatoly Sharansky responds that he's in the triangle next to him, he throws up the paper to the ceiling. Day one, he misses. Day two, he misses again. Three, four, and five, he can't get it through there. It's the last day of Natan Sharansky's shiva. And he throws with all his might, he throws the balled up piece of paper through the ceiling, it makes it through the crack, and then he hears not the saddest words, but the happiest words of his ordeal. Natan Sharansky says, I got it. I got the piece of paper. And Natan Sharansky reports to him through the toilet telephone in the subsequent nights how he recited the Kaddish and how he knew in his moment of vulnerability he was not alone. The story represents the struggle for survival of two particularly heroic and two particularly famous Jews. But it also highlights the intersection between Bein Adam L'Chaveiro and Bein Adam L'Makom. A Jew is never alone. A Jew always has the ability to reach out to and to connect to God Himself. But sometimes the only way we are able to do that is when we connect first to others. Nathan Sharansky gets the Kaddish from the hands and from the throw of Yosef Mendelovich. Yosef Mendelovich knows that the reason why he has that Kaddish in his mind is so that he can share it and inspire Nathan Sharansky with it when the time is right. You know why the Tzitz Eliezer writes that the sound of the shofar works only when you're in a tzibur? Because the inspiration of the shofar is reflected in the faces and in the actions of the people around us. It's an amazing thing. Many righteous people, myself for many years, have the custom. It makes sense. You want to heighten your sense of hearing. So what's a natural thing to do when the Baal Tokeya is blowing shofar? You close your eyes. The Tzitz Eliezer, it would seem to me, is suggesting, not so fast. Don't close your eyes. Look around the shul. Look around at the grandmothers. Look around at the grandchildren. Look around at your friends who didn't have to be here, who might not want to be here, but is making an effort nevertheless. Look at the reflection of inspiration on the face of friends, on the face of a chevra. You know, as an educator, I can tell you how many times at the end of the year, whether it's an NCSY Kollel in the summer or other NCSY programs or camps in the summer, whether it is in yeshiva or whether it is in a seminary or a school, and it's the end of the year banquet, and people are reflecting on what they gained. And people say, it was great, but the best thing was the friends. And as a Rebbe, part of me is like, really? That's the best? Just the friends? Because like, friends, everybody's got friends. And you can make friends everywhere. And is that what we are? Is that what Shalvim for Women is? Is that what Reishit is? Is that what the great yeshivas and the great summer program, is that what they are? They're factories for making friends? Absolutely, positively, yes. They're factories for making the type of friends that help us discover the Ribono Shel Olam. They're factories for making us recognize the profound and deep connection that exists between Bein Adam L'Makom and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. That's what they are. That's as good as they get, and that's plenty good enough. That's what we came here to accomplish, and whatever we came here to accomplish, all of us with our own individual goals, all of us with our own individual problems, all of us with our own individual needs, but we came to accomplish these incredible goals together. We came to join hands with each other, take inspiration from each other, take help from each other, take companionship and support from each other, and rise up in a unified way to meet the challenges of our generation. In the MTA gym on that night, my student's father told me the following story. He was a normal, modern Orthodox man, whatever that means. Alright, I'll tell you what it means. It means that he went to shul, usually on Shabbos, stood in the back and he spoke. And speaking of Yosef Mendelovich's Kaddish, that changed the day that his father passed away. Earlier in the year of the story that I'm describing to you. And he committed himself, even though it was not his norm, that throughout the year of Avelus, throughout the 11 months of saying Kaddish, it's not an unusual Kabbalah. For him, it was pretty unusual. He was not going to miss a minyan. Not Shacharis, not Mincha, and not Maariv. To tell you how unusual and difficult that is, because it may sound easy, his wife and my student, who was in the 11th grade at the time, said, "We are so impressed and so moved by that commitment and gesture, we commit to do it with you." They each lasted less than 10 days. That's how long his wife and how long his son lasted. After that, they said, "We still support you. We still respect you. Good luck. Have a good time doing it, because that's crazy. We have a schedule. We have a life. We're not going a minyan three times a day. You do it." He scheduled everything. doctor trip, doctor office, family vacations, and of course all of his work, he scheduled it around Minyanim. This was pre-godavin.com. There was no internet. There was no easy way of finding out where all the Minyanim were. He was the app before there were apps. He knew every early morning Shacharis Minyan in the tri-state area, and more importantly, every late night Maariv Minyan in the tri-state area. 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, some shtiebel in Brooklyn, he knew exactly where it was and when they're davening. One day, that day of the hockey game, his boss calls him into the office. And his boss says to him, well, it was actually the week before that he called him in, but he called him in and he said to him, you have a business trip. I'm pretty sure it was in Louisville, Kentucky, but I'm not positive about that. It was somewhere in Kentucky. You have a business trip in Louisville, Kentucky. I need you to go out next Monday to Louisville. The first thing he thinks of are his three minyanim. Chakras, no problem. He's not going to sleep over, even though that's normally what they do in business. He's not going to sleep over, though. Early minyan, he's going to be able to do it in New York. Late night Maariv, he's going to get back after the hockey game, no problem. What's he going to do about mincha? Tells his boss, I'm not sure I can go. Goes home, tells his wife, but it says his wife says, you're crazy. Go speak to someone. They'll tell you about minyanim in Louisville, Kentucky. Remember, pre-internet. He makes a couple of calls, he speaks to some of his friends. They say, what's the issue? Call Chabad. He calls up Chabad, and they say, no, we have no Chabad, believe it or not. In this city, it might have been Louisville. And he says, all right, what can I do? He's about to hang up the phone. They say, wait, why hanging up the phone? He says, because you said you have no Chabad. He said, yeah, we have no Chabad in Louisville, Kentucky. We do have a Chabad in Cincinnati, Ohio. Chabad in Cincinnati, Ohio is a good drive. It's not as crazy as it sounds, even though it's a different state. It's a couple of hours drive from Cincinnati. They said, let's call the people in Cincinnati. Maybe they'll meet you in the airport. It says, meet me in the airport? That's completely crazy. They say, let me make a call. I'll get back to you. He gets a call back later. The person says on the other line, I don't have a lot of time. What time's your flight? My flight's at 3. Be at the gate an hour and a half. This is pre-9/11 also. Be at the gate an hour and a half before your flight. Also, no TSA. That's important for the story. Be at the gate an hour and a half before the flight. There'll be a minion there for you. Wait a second. She hangs up the phone. There's nothing else to talk about. Okay. He gets to the gate an hour and a half before his flight. He's sitting there. There's another plane that's ready to take off because that's the way they work at airport gates. And there's a guy sitting there across from him. Everybody gets on the first plane. The two of them are left there. The guy starts making small talk with him. They're the only two guys waiting in the waiting area. Nobody else around. Nobody looks remotely Jewish. Guy says to him, hey, you're the type of guy who likes to get here early also, aren't you? As he asks, sort of, yeah. Starts talking about punctuality and about getting to places 2 hours ahead of time. Guy's talking his ear off. Finally, guy says to him, listen, I'm not really that kind of guy, and I really need to be doing my own thing here. Okay, a little rude, fine. Why aren't you that kind of guy? Then why are you here 2 hours early? So the guy says, listen, there's nothing like the truth. Figures nothing but the truth to tell him. I know I'm going to get rid of him. He tells him the story. He says, listen, I'm a Jew, and my father passed away a few months ago. And there's a special prayer recite. We need a quorum. I mean, if this doesn't scare a person off in the airport, what will? There's a quorum of people that we require for this prayer. I'm waiting for some of my religious friends to come so that we can start moving back and forth and praying to God, knowing that this will get the guy to shut up finally. And it works. The guy is quiet, like the room has totally fallen. The guy's completely quiet, not another word, for 10 minutes. 10 minutes later, the guy turns to him and says, go through that part again about the prayer and what you're doing. So he says, yeah, special prayer that we recite when a parent passes away, and I'm waiting for a quorum and man. And he sees there's something going on there. So the guy says to him, you're probably not going to believe this. Says, but my father passed away 7 months ago as well. I've never been religious a day in my life. Somebody told me about this prayer, about this thing called Kaddish, and it sounded like the right thing to do. So I went into a synagogue. Now, I don't know if it was Reformed, Conservative, Orthodox, it doesn't matter. I went into a synagogue, but it did not work for me. I did not know what to say. I couldn't read the prayer book. Nobody tried to help me. Nobody explained. I wasn't angry. I had no expectations. But I basically walked in. I put on one of those silly things. I walked out, and I said, Dad, I tried, and it was over. That was 7 months ago. Now I haven't said Kaddish one time. I haven't said this prayer one time. Are there rules? Are there like access points? Am I allowed to say this Kaddish with you? And the guy says, no, there are no rules. You can say it together with me. at the appointed time on the dot, almost like a clown car, a minivan pulls up in front of the airport. 9 Lubavitch Hasidim come out of the airport from all places in Ohio. They join him by the gate over there. This guy gets his mincha minyan, and he gets to say a kaddish after the mincha minyan, word by word, with his new friend in the airport in the middle of Kentucky. Yiskadal, yiskadal, v'yiskadash, v'yiskadash, shimei, shimei, rabbah. A kaddish of two strangers sanctifying the name of their deceased parents together and sanctifying the name of the God together. The mincha minyan ends. The guy, who's from a very affluent neighborhood in a New York suburb, he says to the Chabad people, "You don't know how much I appreciate this. You don't know how much this means to me. You don't know what this did for this guy." They say, "We know, we see this all the time. It's not a big deal for us. You know, this is what we do." And he says, "Okay, though." He takes out his checkbook and he starts to write for them a big donation for Chabad. The guy puts his hand down and he says, "Put that away. Your money's not good here. This is not for money. This is how you're going to pay us back. You're going to pay us back because you're going to remember that there was a Jew in Kentucky who needed help, and there were other Jews that said, we are in this together." He got on his plane, he came to his hockey game out of breath, and he tells me that story and tells me that I should tell you that story too. Because that story, that statement, there was a Jew in Kentucky who needed help, and there was another group of Jews who said, we're in this together. That's why the Tzitz Eliezer says, don't blow the shofar in your basement, don't blow the shofar in your living room. That's why Avram Avinu, the Ish Chesed, is able to discover God. Because we are in this together, and because we discover God when we look beyond ourselves, and because these relationships, ani l'dodi v'dodi li, in both senses of the word, ish l're'eu matanos l'avyonim, are what propel us through these days. We give each other the greetings of ksiva v'chasima tova. We embrace each other. We dance together. We sing together. We learn together. We approach God and we say, there is more to this world than just me, and therefore I know, God, that there is a you. And I know that I am not perfect, but I have friends who I will help me, and I have friends whom I will help. And that's the way we present ourselves on the Day of Judgment. And through the recognition of those three, through the recognition that our kaddish can be wrapped up in a ball and thrown through the tiniest of cracks to help another person, and that their kaddish can be used to help me, and through that act of opening up to others, of connecting as a group and connecting as a chevra, we encounter God, we establish the greatest of relationships, which is our connection and our love to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, and we have the most awesome of awesome days, the most holy of holiest days, and the greatest judgment that awaits each and every one of us. Everyone should have it, ksiva chasima tova, and I look forward to hopefully getting together with you at some point in the future, and wish you great hatzlacha in all your learning, all your growing, and all your relationships throughout the year. Thank you.